Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. These are the stories coming up on today's program. Protecting the poor. As Pope Benedict urges the leaders at the G20 summit to maintain development aid for poor countries, we hear from Caritas why we need to put ethics back into the economy. Africa Revisited. At his general audience, the Pope recalls his recent pastoral visit to Cameroon and Angola and thanks his hosts for their warm and enthusiastic welcome. Divided Island. The president of Cyprus, Dimitris Christofiras, speaks to us about his meeting with the Pope and about the issues surrounding the continuing division of the island between the Greek Cypriot and Turkish Cypriot sectors. And Land Off Limits. We hear more about the plight of Brazil's landless peasants and how the Catholic Church is campaigning to speed up the slow pace of agrarian reform. God has shown us by turning stone to bread, and so we all must lend a helping hand. Pope Benedict is urging world leaders attending the G20 summit in London to maintain development aid for poor countries, despite the global economic crisis. The Pope wrote to the British Prime Minister Gordon Brown, asking that he and the other G20 leaders don't forget the world's poor as they try to chart a way out of the crisis. In his letter, Pope Benedict recalled his recent visit to Africa and said the poor are going to be the greatest victims of the crisis, yet bear no responsibility for it. He also called for a return to ethics in finance and said the measures proposed by the G20 to rein in the crisis must offer security to families and stability to workers. In his reply to the Pope, Brown said that one of his top priorities for the summit was protecting the poor and ensuring wealthy countries keep their promises on development aid. In the run-up to the G20 summit in London, Caritas Internationalis issued a statement calling on the world leaders to put the poor at the heart of a reform package that will build a new low-carbon economy based on justice and equality. Caritas said ethics need to be put back into the economy and urged the G20 leaders not to be content with patching up what it called the failed globalization of greed. Patrick Nicholson is the head of communications at Caritas, and he told me why a radical reform of the current global financial system is urgently needed.
Caritas thinks that G20 really needs to restructure the global economy. There's no point in just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. What we really need to think about is why we're in this crisis at the moment. And for Caritas, it's because we had a globalization that was based on greed and the pursuit of wealth by the few, and not a globalization of solidarity, a globalization which was working towards creating wealth for all of humanity and improving the lot of everybody. So we really need to use this crisis as an opportunity to see how we can restructure globalization to make it work for us all and not just the powerful few. And that really should be top of the agenda for the G20.
But how easy is it going to be, though, to agree on a reformed alternative system? Because here we've got so many different nations, and each of them going to have their own ideas.
I don't think they have a choice, really. I think it's clear to everybody that the current status quo is no longer workable. So I think world leaders, people going to the G20 conference, really need to think hard and long about how they can work together and how they can produce coordinated policies which will readdress the system. I think you're right, there are lots of competing countries and competing needs, but we are one humanity, and the majority of humanity has been excluded from globalization. They're the have-nots, and so we really need to see the developing countries and developed countries work together to produce the sorts of policies that are required. Things like the World Bank and the IMF at the moment are run by rich countries, and what we need to see is poor countries have a say in how they're run and have a say in how the architecture, if you like, of globalization is governed.
In fact, there's already been many of the up-and-coming countries like China, India and Brazil that have been flexing their muscles and plainly want more say in the running of the global financial system. So do you think we're going to see quite a strong push on their part?
I hope so. I think it's not just emerging economies such as China and India and Brazil, but it's also poor countries which need a say too. The least developed countries in sub-Saharan Africa or Latin America or Asia, which have been excluded up to this point. And many of the policies are ones which affect their country, so not to give them a say in how globalization works or how countries are bailed out is not democratic, and it's also not very effective, because we all know that if people can decide their own policies, then they're more likely to work than ones that are imposed on them from outside. And, you know, that's what happened in the 1990s and failed. And so we shouldn't really repeat those mistakes of the past.
There comes a time when we heed a certain call, when the world must come together as one.
Do you agree then with those... Well, there are many, you know, civil society and church activists that, in fact, see almost a golden opportunity as a result of this crisis. You know, this opportunity, as you said, to press for really radical reforms to create a more equitable, ethical and transparent system. So, in a sense, good can come out of bad.
I think we can either meet this crisis with paralysis and do-nothing mentality, or we can say, you know, let's patch up the boat and get it back on its feet and carry on as we were before, or we can really see it as an opportunity to create a globalization based on solidarity, justice and peace, and for the poor who've been the least responsible for the economic crisis but who are going to pay the biggest price. That's really what we need to see happen. It's completely scandalous that we're seeing trillions of dollars raised in hours to rescue the banking crisis, whereas at the same time rich countries are cutting their aid budgets, and that cannot carry on. And on climate change, again, we can't allow rich countries to dodge the fact that we need to see dramatic cuts. We need to see a good agreement on climate change in a meeting in Copenhagen in December, and we need to see extra aid, extra financing to help poor countries cope with the impact of climate change. Whereas we could bail out the banks, we're not going to be able to bail out the climate if we make decisions that are too late.
There is, though, a lot of, shall we say, public awareness, as you say, of the greed and all that was wrong with the current financial system. You know, there's been this very considerable anger against, for instance, the huge bonuses paid to executives of companies that required government help to be bailed out. And we saw earlier the row over the bonuses paid to the leading staff at the American insurance giant AIG. Do you think this has perhaps helped ordinary people to see this greed that was displayed by the rich and powerful, and perhaps help make people more aware and less selfish and greedy in the future?
I hope so. I think the old system based on creating large amounts of debt, on consumerism, was just not sustainable, not just for the rich, but for middle-class people in Europe and North America too, and elsewhere around the world. That idea that you can have an economy that is based on consumer spending, money which the consumer doesn't have, money on credit, is just not either something that we want or something that is sustainable in the long term. So I hope not just the rich and powerful, but everybody takes a look back at how they live their lives and whether they can live their lives in a much more sustainable, eco-friendly way where consumerism isn't at the center of their existence, and really look at ways where on an individual level we can improve the world that we live in and also cut back on our rampant consumerism. And that's really the only way that we're going to tackle some of these big issues, is that the individual person decides to change their life and persuades other people to follow in that example. We all bear responsibility for this crisis, the situation that we're in, and because of the lives that we've led. And we really need to think about that and change our approach.
I see that Caritas is calling, in fact, for a new international system for wealth distribution, and you're also calling for measures to be taken to tackle tax evasion, the issue of tax havens. Can you tell us a little bit more about your proposals on these matters?
In terms of redistribution, I mean, there are clever tax schemes where we can change the way that money is distributed. So, for example, the taxes on aeroplane travel or fuel taxes, that money that we can tax these things and put that money back into climate change mitigation or into development. Clever schemes which hopefully would cut air travel, something that we need to do, and do that by putting money into climate mitigation and into aid. Tax evasion, I mean, it's one of those things that people don't talk about enough. Huge sums of money are lost because of tax evasion and illicit capital flows. 350 billion to 500 billion is lost by poor countries alone. And we really need to see a crackdown on tax evasion and tax havens. So sanctions against countries which offer those tax havens and sanctions against businesses which use them, and a code of conduct that is adopted at an international level through the UN which fights tax evasion. I think at the moment there's a lack of transparency with what companies pay governments to operate in their countries. Say, for example, oil companies don't have to publish what they pay governments to operate. So, you know, that creates bad governance, and that can create the problems that we've seen in Africa, where you've had resource-led conflicts. And if we know what companies are paying governments and we know how to hold those governments to account, I mean, it's not just rich countries, it's also poor countries too, improving their governance. And so if we can hold them to account, hold their budgets to account, then we can move forward. I mean, one of the our partners in Tanzania and Zambia, one of the things that they do is they record the cost of living, and they record what governments are spending on health and education and their budgets, and they challenge them and they hold them to book. And they can only do that because of the huge effort that Caritas at international level and other NGOs have put into creating civil society and creating the kind of mechanisms in those countries where governments can be held to account.
You said earlier that, of course, this economic crisis will impact on poor people the most, but do you think the worst there is still to come?
I have no doubt that it's going to be much worse for developing countries. I mean, we've already seen some of the impact with the food riots that we had last year, really across the world. So we're really seeing, you know, a large number of people now who can't afford enough food to eat. 150 million people now more have been driven into poverty. There is a sort of sense of we've stepped over the cliff, and at the moment we're kind of hovering in the middle of air like a sort of cartoon character waiting to plummet. But I think in developing countries, we're already seeing that plummet. You know, the commodity prices have gone way down. So if you look at countries like Zambia, for example, which produces copper prices have really plummeted, and the government in Zambia doesn't have as much income from exports, which means it can't spend as much on health and education. And, you know, where there is no safety net in a poor country, where you don't have a national health service, the poor people are directly being impacted by that today. I think that's clear.
I was speaking to Patrick Nicholson of Caritas Internationalis.
God's great big family, and the truth, you know, love is all we need.
At his general audience on Wednesday, Pope Benedict recalled his recently concluded visit to the African nations of Cameroon and Angola, and thanked his hosts for their warm and enthusiastic welcome. Emma McCarthy reports.
In uncertain spring weather, the weekly general audience returned to St. Peter's Square this Wednesday, where pilgrims and tourists were treated to Pope Benedict's analysis of his first ever pastoral visit to the church in Africa.
My stay began in Cameroon, where I had the pleasure of meeting various Catholic groups as well as representatives of the Muslim community. I was struck by the profound religious spirit of this nation and the desire of its citizens to live and work together in peace.
In fact, it was in Cameroon that Pope Benedict handed the working document for October 2nd African Synod to the bishops of the church, undoubtedly the focal point of this papal trip.
A particularly significant moment of my visit was the presentation of the Instrumentum Laboris for the second Special Assembly for Africa of the Synod of Bishops. As the church prepares for this important meeting dedicated to the theme, the Church in Africa in Service to Reconciliation, Justice and Peace, I ask you all to join me in praying that it will bear abundant fruit among the beloved people of this great continent.
Then Pope Benedict went on to reflect on the second leg of his trip.
My journey then took me to Angola, a country that continues to strive for reconciliation and reconstruction after a long civil war. I encouraged all Angolans to contribute to this task, especially by forming the conscience of young people.
The Pope decried the many conflicts which he said still afflict the African continent today, adding that the Church must be a sign of unity and reconciliation, so that together all African nations can build a future of justice, solidarity and peace by putting into practice the teaching of the Gospel. Then, looking ahead towards Thursday's anniversary of John Paul II's death, he told all those present Wednesday that he is fervently praying for the beatification of his beloved predecessor.
Upon all of you, invoke God's abundant blessings of joy and peace.
I'm Emma McCarthy.
Pope Benedict and the President of Cyprus, Dimitris Christofias, have discussed matters regarding the present and future of Cyprus, which remains divided following the Turkish invasion of the north in 1974. After the audience with the Pope last Friday, Charles Collins spoke to President Christofias and began by asking him about his meeting with the Holy Father.
The meeting with the Pope was perfect. I'm happy to be accepted by His Holiness the Pope. I consider him as a natural friend of Cyprus and of the Cypriots, because he is against injustice. He is, let me say, fighter for justice, for human rights, and for the rights of the ordinary human beings in the street. So it is natural that I've been accepted very warmly in a very nice atmosphere, and with full understanding. He worries about, of course, the destruction of the culture and especially the religious heritage in the occupied area of Cyprus. Because, you know, we used to call Cyprus a land of saints and heroes. So almost 500 of churches destroying monuments, icons, stolen icons, mosaics. So let me say that we are alliance for the restoration of this cultural heritage, to save what remain, because there is a danger for churches, but and for whole monasteries to become ruins. On the other hand, Pope is very sensitive towards the tortures of whole peoples in Africa. This disaster, which is the characteristic in Africa, I mean the hunger, the poverty, the diseases. And he asks the powers in the world to implement, in spite of the economical crisis, the Millennium Goals, and to add more assistance to these countries. As you understand, I'm absolutely in favor. So we spoke in a very open-minded atmosphere, and we agreed on all these matters. He wants Cyprus to be united. He wants Cyprus, as we want Cyprus, to become a bridge of peace, of common understanding, of friendly relations between the European Union, because Cyprus is a southern part of the European Union, with the Arab countries and peoples, and with Israel as well. I mean, the peoples of the whole region. It's in a crossing point, Cyprus, as you know. So this is my vision as well. This is a vision of the Pope as well. So we had a very, very nice meeting, and I'm sure that as soon as possible, the Pope is going to visit Cyprus to see what is happening. Of course, hoping that the process for the reunification will start even before his arrival to this island.
Speaking of that process, you have said that there is no plan B in this process. Is it now or never? Is this the last chance for a peace deal on Cyprus?
I insist that we have to solve the problem. If I express messages of plan B and plan C, that means that I don't believe to the reunification. So, of course, it's a very important chance. I will never say this is the last chance, because I wouldn't be surrendered. And my people as well wouldn't be surrendered to its fate. No, the fate of Cyprus is a united Cyprus. And the fate of the people of Cyprus is a united people. In spite of the different languages or the different faiths, religious I mean, or customs, because we have in common customs with the Turkish Cypriots. Usually, during the Eastern holidays and other religious holidays, we celebrated together with the Turkish Cypriots. And as well, we took part in their services, in their bairams and other religious holidays. And not only this, the dances, the people's dances are the same. Greek Cypriots and Turkish Cypriots could dance with the same music. Many, many songs. Our kitchen, it is absolutely the same. So we have so much common, and it is a pity to leave it aside and to give the opportunity to the foreigners to destroy the common we created through centuries. So no plan B, only one and unique plan, the reunification of our common homeland.
And you mentioned in your press conference the role of Turkey. Do you see any movement on that part? Do you see the Turks coming around on the issue of Cyprus?
The Turks are around, but how much around and for what purpose we must research, let's say so. You see, in Turkey, there are internal problems. The visions of the politicians to promote the accession of Turkey to the European Union, and there are other visions by establishments. In deep state, we call it the Kemalist establishment. I think that regarding Cyprus, these establishments are not in the correct line. They want to control Cyprus forever. And of course, it is not possible to accept a solution which is going to create conditions for Turkey or for any other foreign country to control our homeland. So these are the obstacles. And for the political leaders of Turkey, the will from our side is there. I hope that as soon as possible, the Turkish leadership will overcome any difficulties and to follow policies which are reasonable to solve the problem on the basis of the interests of the Cypriots only, and not any other country or people.
That was President Christofias of Cyprus talking to Charles Collins. Agrarian reform has been a burning issue for decades in Brazil, a country where nearly half of all land is controlled by less than 2% of the population. President Lula da Silva came to power in 2002, pledging to expropriate land and settle poor peasants. However, land reform advocates say the pace of agrarian reform has stalled in recent years and accuse the president of abandoning support for the landless in order to back big farm business, which has boomed under his administration. Derek Indo is a Catholic doctor from the English city of Bath, who has recently returned from a visit to Brazil where he met church activists campaigning for land reform. He spoke to me about his impressions.
I went to a national seminar at which Bishop Thomas Balduino was present, and the conclusion was that agrarian reform is stalled and needs to be completely looked at from anew.
So why has land reform stalled? Why is it proving so difficult to distribute the land to the landless peasants? Is it because of the power and influence of the nation's landowning lobby?
There is obviously a lot of vested interest in maintaining control of the land, and I think President Lulu cannot actually do the deals he'd like to get land reform to happen.
Many people have been killed, such as Sister Dorothy Stang, a US-born Catholic sister who championed the rights of the landless. Is there still a lot of intimidation going on there against those who try to speak up for the rights of the landless? I know that you spent a lot of your time with Father Leo Dolan, an Irish-born priest who now works out there in Brazil and has been there indeed for many decades.
Yes, while we were there, in fact, 20 families went up under the auspices of MCC, which is the Movimento Camponeses Corumbiara, the People of the Fields movement arising out of Corumbiara, to settle on the land. And they were intimidated by the local landowners. They phoned Father Leo on the bus to say this, and he was about 1,000 miles away from them, so couldn't actually help. But he phoned the land reform agency called INCRA to see if they could go and protect them and help them. So yes, and that's just one isolated incident. Sister Dorothy was a far more coordinated action against someone who had done a great deal for the country and for the people and was well respected.
You talked there about, you know, how people are being intimidated. What sort of form does this intimidation make? Is it verbal threats? Do they sometimes resort to physical violence? Can you give us some more details there?
There is quite a catalogue of murders which have still to come before the courts. The most horrendous national, what they call a massacre, was at Corumbiara, where 10 people were killed. But there are isolated incidents happening every day of intimidation, both physical and verbal.
So when you went out and about and met these landless Brazilians, did you find there was quite a lot of disappointment, given that President Lulu's government had come to power, you know, pledging to do more to speed agrarian reform on?
Yes, and the word that comes to mind is desanimado. The leader of MCC used that word to me several times because of the attempts, not just attempts, but well-coordinated thinking and writing of reports, showing how money was being misappropriated, showing how land was being misappropriated, and bringing this to the knowledge of the authorities has been disregarded.
Can you tell us a bit more about the role of the church? You said there that you heard this address by Bishop Thomas Balduino, who said that the agrarian reform had rather stalled at the moment. But what is it doing in concrete terms to stick up for the rights of these landless people?
Bishop Thomas came to this seminar, which I attended in Brasilia, as a mark of solidarity with the people. And he said that word maybe is a bit overused, but it was to be with them. He's been with them since the 70s and seen how things have changed over that period. He was unequivocal in stating that the church is fully behind the people who want land.
I was speaking to Derek Indo about his visit to Brazil. Well, that's all from Vatican Radio's English programme for today, but we'll be back on the air at the same time tomorrow. Laudato Jesus Christus.